How could you doubt my love? Even if she could doubt it, why would she? Why make life harder than it had to be? She was so tired from all of it, too tired to fight it anymore, too tired to run every time someone she loved disappointed her. So, that was that. She was going. Mason wasn't. Elizabeth Daily Post, June Wedding, June 22nd. Miss Leah Rose Cohen, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Seymour Cohen of Cleveland, Ohio, and Mr. Henry Joel Ammerman, son of Mrs. Irene Ammerman and the late Max Ammerman of Elizabeth, were married this afternoon by Rabbi Gershon B. Chertoff at the Hotel Lorraine in Bradley Beach. The bride graduated from Ohio State University. The groom served in World War II with the Army in Europe. He is a graduate of Rutgers University and is a reporter for the Daily Post. The bride wore a tea-length dress of white dotted Swiss with a pink sash and carried a bouquet of new dawn roses and peonies. The groom's sister, Mrs. Rusty Ammerman of Elizabeth, was matron of honor. She wore a pale pink sheath. The two bridesmaids, Pamela Cohen of Cleveland, sister of the bride, and Mary Ammerman of Elizabeth, niece of the groom, wore matching dresses in deep pink cotton sateen. The couple will honeymoon in Atlantic City before moving to their new home in Washington, D.C. Chapter 33. Mary. It was a perfect day at the Jersey Shore. Breezy, but not so breezy. Their hairstyles were ruined, or the chuppah was in danger of blowing over. Mary was annoyed that Rusty thought she needed to lecture her that morning about how this was Henry and Leah's big day, and no matter what else was happening, no matter what else they were thinking or feeling, they were going to be happy for Henry and Leah. As if Mary needed to be told. As if she would come to Henry's wedding and mope over her own loss. Although she felt her loss every minute of every day, her love for Henry was stronger. Leah's mother was chatty but stayed close to Aunt Alma. She and Irene both wore beige at Leah's request, a color that didn't suit either of them. Irene draped a flattering pink floral scarf around her neck and gave a matching scarf to Leah's mother, who was grateful. Leah's father didn't mingle. "Size arthritis is bothering him," Leah's mother explained to anyone who asked. Dr. O and Rusty decided it was too soon to be out together as a couple, so he didn't come to the wedding. But Ben Sapphire did, and he kept Leah's father company, making sure he had enough to drink to be cheerful, but no more. Neither Leah's sister, who had just finished her sophomore year at Ohio State, nor Mary had ever attended a wedding, let alone been bridesmaids. They were seated together at lunch, chicken a la king with crispy noodles and rice. Pamela joked that the restaurant must be part Chinese, part ladies' tea room, making Mary laugh. But it reminded her of going to lunch with Frecky before the play at the Paper Mill Playhouse. After the wedding cake was presented, after Leah fed a piece to Henry, and Henry fed a piece to Leah, and the couple were toasted with champagne, and the photographer, Henry's friend, Todd Dirksen, captured it all, it was time for Leah to turn her back to the crowd and throw her bouquet over her shoulder. Rusty and Mary stepped out of the way. The bouquet landed in Irene's hands, who treated it like a hot potato, quickly tossing it toward Leah's friends, where Harriet McKenna caught it and promptly passed out. She was rescued by the photographer, who had met her when he'd covered the holiday party at the Elks Club. Once upon a time, Mary had planned to wear her bridesmaid dress with its detachable organza overskirt to the ninth grade prom, but she decided against going. When her friends saw the depth of her sadness, they accepted her decision. In the same once upon a time, she'd thought she'd wear the dress to Mason's junior prom at Jefferson. She wondered if he'd go without her, if he'd go with someone else. She doubted it. Or maybe that was just what she was hoping. She couldn't imagine ever wearing the dress again. Mason. Polina kept her job working in the kitchen at Janet, but Mason avoided her like bad food. The kid, too. He was done with all that. No more girlfriends. They wanted too much from you. They expected you to make them happy, even when they said they wanted to make you happy. Maybe someday he'd feel ready to see Miri again, but he couldn't think when that might be. He'd fucked up big time. He didn't expect her to forgive him. The question was, could he forgive himself? Jack wouldn't let it go, begged him to come with him and Christina to Las Vegas. Mason finally said, "Don't ask me again, Jack. I'm staying here, at Janet. I'll be fine. At least come with us for the summer." "I can't. I've got a job. You know that. You're the one who set me up with your old boss. He's going to train me to be an electrician, just like he trained you. He'd understand." "No. Mason, you can't live your life avoiding Miri." "Don't say that name around me. And yes, I can. And I will. There'll be other girls, believe me." "Cut it out, Jack, because you don't know." "I know you're 17. That doesn't mean shit." He hoped Jack wouldn't cry. He looked like he might. So Mason gave him a bear hug. That way they didn't have to look at each other. Jack patted his back for too long. "Hey, brother," Mason said, to get Jack to let go. "I'll write." "Every week," Jack said, sniffling. "I need you to promise." "I promise." "And I'll call every 2 weeks," Jack told him, "on Sunday nights." Mason nodded. Then he asked what he'd been thinking all along. "What about 1A, Jack?" "No word yet. I'll see you for Christmas, okay?" "Yeah, sure. Christmas." Steve. The morning after graduating from Jefferson High, Steve went downtown to the Army Recruitment Center on Elizabeth Avenue and enlisted. He filled out all the paperwork, set up an appointment for a physical that afternoon, and he was in. It was that easy. Phil was apoplectic. "Are you crazy? We're going to Lehigh, not Korea." "You'll have to go without me." "Steve, come on." "It's done." "Do your parents know?" "They will. They're going to go apeshit." Steve shrugged. He told his father first. He went to his office, hoping to catch him before he left. His father was staying at the Elizabeth Carteret Hotel these days, in the same room where Joseph Fluitt, the guy who'd investigated the airplane crashes, had stayed. "Hello, Steve," Daisy said. "Congratulations on your graduation." "Thanks. I have something for you." She pulled out a package wrapped with manly paper and tied with a brown ribbon. "I hope you'll enjoy it." "Thank you, Daisy." "He's with his last patient of the day," Daisy said. "I'll tell him you're waiting." When the last patient left, his father joined him in the waiting room. "How about supper at Three Brothers?" his father said. "I've been eating there a lot lately." "Your girlfriend doesn't cook for you?" His father gave him a sad smile. So Steve said, "Sure, I like their burgers." Steve waited until his father finished his moussaka, then the baklava he'd ordered for dessert. He'd never seen his father eat Greek food. Steve didn't like baklava, too sticky for him. He was off desserts anyway, trying to get into shape before basic training. When he broke his news, his father didn't take it well. "Now?" he said. "You've enlisted now, when we're still fighting in Korea? No, son, I'm not going to let you do this." "Too late, Dad. It's done. I'll get you out of it. I'll tell them you're not yourself." "But I am myself." "No, Steve, you haven't been yourself in a long time." "How would you know?" "I know my son. Not anymore. You don't have any idea who I am." Steve stood up. "Thanks for supper." "Sit down," his father said. "We're not finished." "I'm finished." His father grabbed his arm. "You can't tell your mother about this." "Says who?" Steve shook off his father, saluted him, then marched out of the restaurant. "Hup, 2, 3, 4. Hup, 2, 3, 4. His father followed him out the door and down the street, calling, "Steve, I mean it.
Don't tell your mother. Not now.
Steve stopped. You're not going to be able to fix this, Dad. I'm telling her.
Then I'm coming with you,
his father said.
That should make Mom happy.
His mother was in the den, sitting in her favorite chair, working on a needlepoint canvas. What was she making this time? A pillow for him to take to college? Fern was on the floor in front of the television watching Hopalong Cassidy. Natalie was probably locked in her room.
Hey, Mom!
Steve! I thought you and Phil were going to a graduation party tonight.
I had something more important to do.
His father stepped into the den.
Daddy!
Fern ran to him, jumped into his arms.
You're not supposed to be here, his mother said to his father. Steve, I'd like to talk to you privately,
his father said.
Sorry, Dad.
He faced his mother.
I have some big news.
His mother's face changed. Was she scared or expectant?
I've joined up.
His mother put down her needlepoint.
Joined what?
You're in the army now, he sang, marching around the room. You're not behind a plow. You'll never get rich digging a ditch. You're in the army now.
Fern laughed. What is he talking about? His mother asked his father.
He enlisted,
his father said.
His mother jumped up and lunged at his father. You put him up to this.
Corinne,
his father said, setting Fern down.
He's supposed to go to college, not the army,
his mother shouted.
Natalie appeared in the doorway. This sounds interesting.
Did you know?
His mother asked his father.
Did you?
I just found out,
his father said.
He can't do this. He's a boy. He has no experience.
Take another look, Mom,
Steve said, pulling himself up to his full 6-foot height, shoulders thrown back, eyes straight ahead.
No, Corinne cried. I won't have him throwing his life away.
She ran out of the den with Steve's dad right behind her. A door slammed. Voices were raised.
Nice going, Steve, Natalie said.
I figured you'd appreciate the drama.
Will you wear an army suit? Fern asked.
It's called a uniform, Steve said. And yes, I will.
Will we have a cake to celebrate?
I doubt it,
Steve said.
How about a gun? Natalie asked. Will you get a gun?
Everybody in the army gets a gun.
Don't bring it home.
Later, when he unwrapped Daisy's graduation present, he found something that looked like a handmade book, with long pages covered in red construction paper and black letters spelling out Player Piano by Kurt Vonnegut. Behind it was an old issue of the New Yorker magazine dated January 31, 1948, with a paperclip marking a story, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, by J.D. Salinger. He opened the card.
Dear Steve, I convinced the manager of the Ritz Bookshop to give me these galley proofs of a book that will be published this summer. It is Mr. Vonnegut's first novel. Something tells me you will like this writer. Congratulations on your graduation. Wishing you all the best, always. Daisy. P.S. The Salinger story is one I recently came across while browsing through a stack of old magazines.
For some crazy reason, Daisy's gift made him cry. Maybe because it meant somebody did know him, after all.
Elizabeth Daily Post, A Farewell to Elizabeth, by Henry Ammerman, June 23rd. It is with some sadness that I write this, my last story for the Daily Post. I have been privileged over the past 6 months to report for you on the terrible series of airplane tragedies that has brought this city so much pain and unwanted national attention. As I leave the place of my birth for a job in a new one, the editors have invited me to offer some final thoughts. The investigations of the Civil Aeronautics Board have now been completed. The results will be annoying and may be disbelieved by those who saw sinister forces conspiring to bring about the three crashes in rapid-fire succession. Each plane failed for a different reason, and none of them indicate any pattern of sabotage or nefarious activity. December 16th. The Miami Airlines non-scheduled C-46 that crashed in the Elizabeth River suffered engine failure, apparently from poor maintenance, which led to a catastrophic fire. The pilots had not been adequately trained to shut off fuel to a damaged engine. January 22nd. American Airlines Flight 6780, a Convair 240, was an incoming flight in poor weather conditions. The weather could have caused carburetor ice. While the plane had heaters to preclude this, it is possible the heaters were not activated. But without definite evidence, the CAB was mystified as to the probable cause of the crash. February 11th, National Airlines Flight 101, a four-engine DC-6, suffered a sudden and unexpected reversal of its number 3 propeller. Attempting to correct this, the pilot mistakenly feathered, shut off and locked, his other right-side propeller. With both the right-hand engines out, the CAB concluded the aircraft did not maintain altitude and settled rapidly. In both crash number 1 and number 3, there was a confluence of mechanical problems and mistaken action by the pilot. Perhaps if the Miami Airlines pilot had shut off fuel to the failed engine sooner, or if the pilot of the national plane had feathered the correct engine, they could have recovered altitude and made it back to the airport. Crash number 2 is more problematic, but there remains a possibility that pilot action to overcome icing might have made a difference. The one lesson we can surely learn from these events is that airplanes are complex machines operating in a precarious environment, the air, where any emergency, be it from mechanical failure, human error, or weather hazard, is fraught with peril. The risk is especially great when it occurs at low altitude, giving pilots little opportunity to take corrective action. As if to underscore this point, just after midnight on February 11th, at almost the same time as the final doomed Elizabeth plane was going down, a Pan American airliner from Idlewild Airport lost an engine just after takeoff. But that pilot was free to maneuver over the Atlantic Ocean, unconcerned with multi-story buildings or thousands at risk on the ground, and returned to the field in safety. Every effort must be taken to safeguard heavily inhabited areas from takeoffs and landings. Let us hope the Port Authority will take this lesson to heart before reopening Newark Airport. Chapter 34. Miri. She was sure they would drive. See the USA in your Chevrolet, even if their Chevrolet was an Oldsmobile. But she was wrong. They were going to fly. Off we go into the wild blue yonder. She couldn't keep songs about flying out of her head, and especially the ending of that song, Live in Fame or Go Down in Flame. Not that she'd lived in fame, but still, she'd seen what it was like to go down in flame, and she didn't want any part of it. That was putting it mildly. I really don't want to fly, she told Rusty. Rusty said, I understand. If you understand, why would you make me do it? I don't want you to spend your life avoiding travel. I want you to see the world. I'll drive. You can't drive across the ocean. I'll take a boat. Everyone will be flying, Mary. That doesn't mean I have to be like everyone else. No, but you don't want your fears to limit your possibilities. That sounds like something Dr. O would say, not you. But it makes sense, doesn't it? Mary shrugged. Did it? Christina and Jack are driving to Las Vegas. Are you saying you want to go with them? Because I don't think that would be appropriate. Before her world fell apart, Mary might have begged to go with them. Mason surely would have been along. She hadn't seen Christina or Jack since the breakup. She hated the word, breakup. It reminded her of Henry's description of the third crash, like a swollen cream puff that had broken apart. She felt as if she, too, had broken apart.
I still don't see why we can't drive.
The sooner we get there, the sooner we can establish residency.
Rusty was losing patience, Miri could tell.
It takes 6 weeks before you can get a divorce, and we can't get married until the divorce is final.
Married. She sometimes forgot that her mother was going to marry Dr. O. He would be her stepfather. He'd be there for dinner at night, asking about her day, like a real father. But what about his kids? How would that make them feel? Sometimes, she didn't blame Natalie for hating him.
Christina.
It didn't hit her until they made it to Las Vegas in Jack's truck, how far she was from home. She cried for 2 days when she saw the dusty road stop of a desert town with a couple of motels and flashy signs spelling out casino or bar, surrounded by brown and red mountains, mostly untouched by vegetation. She expected green, not brown, and summer flowers, not cacti. She couldn't get out of bed. She wouldn't eat. Jack enlisted Daisy's help. Daisy had arrived before them to start setting up the new office. She'd been there a week when Jack and Christina finally made it. Daisy came to the cheap motel where Christina and Jack were staying until they found an apartment to rent, urged her out of bed, helped her into the shower, and chose a sundress for her to wear to lunch at the Flamingo, a swell hotel with a pool owned by some of Dr. O's friends.
"What have I done?"
Christina asked Daisy, once they were seated with menus in front of them. She let Daisy order for both of them.
"What am I doing here?"
"I'd say you're homesick, sweetie, but that will pass. Remember, you can always go back. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy an open ticket on a plane from here to New York and keep it in my office drawer. It's yours, anytime you want it."
Daisy reached across the table and touched Christina's hand.
"Thank you, Daisy. I don't know what I'd do without you."
She picked up her burger and took a bite. She'd forgotten how hungry she was.
"Mmm, good," she said.
Daisy laughed and took a bite of hers.
"It is, isn't it?"
After lunch, Daisy said,
"I have something to show you."
They drove in Daisy's new white Ford convertible to a long, low building just out of town.
"Welcome to the Las Vegas Medical Arts Building," Daisy said.
Inside, she walked Christina through the hall to a large, almost finished suite of offices.
"This will be your new home away from home, the dental offices of Dr. Arthur Allen Osner and Associates."
Christina was overwhelmed by the scope of the project, by the newness of everything.
"We're interviewing dentists and dental assistants every day," Daisy told her, "all trained at the best dental schools in the country, general dentistry, orthodontia, oral surgery, periodontics, all in one section of the building. It's going to be a big operation, the biggest and best in the area. And you, Christina Demetrius, are my second in command."
"McKittrick," Christina said.
"What?"
Daisy asked. "Christina McKittrick. I'm married, remember?"
"Of course," Daisy said. "Christina McKittrick."
There was no office furniture yet, but there were two card tables set up, each holding a typewriter.
"This will be my station," Daisy said, leaning against one of the card tables, "and the other will be yours."
"I have my own station?" Christina asked. "My own typewriter?"
"You do."
"Can I try it?" Daisy passed her a sheet of paper. Christina removed the cover from the new Smith Corona and rolled in the paper. She stood as she typed, "Christina McKittrick, Mrs. Jack McKittrick, Christina and Jack McKittrick of Las Vegas, Nevada." She wasn't alone, she reminded herself. She had Jack. She had Daisy. And Dr. O and his new family would be here soon. They would be her new family. Hers and Jack's. It would be okay. Never mind that Mama had fallen to her knees, wailing, when Christina left.
Even though she'd promised to come home for Christmas, just like a college student, Mama cried, "No, Christina, don't go!" It took her father to get her mother to stop screaming, to get her back into the house.
"I hope you're happy," Athena said, the new baby in her arms. "I doubt Mama will live to see Christmas."
"What do you mean? Did you ever hear of dying of a broken heart?"
"Mama's not going to die."
"But if she does, it's on your head, Christina."
Athena turned and disappeared inside. When Baba came back, he hugged her.
"I don't know what you're doing, but I wish you Nasagala, Sagapo. I'll always love you. You'll always be my daughter."
"I love you too," she whispered into his neck. "Take care of Mama."
"Mama will be all right."
He pressed 5 crisp $20 bills into her hand. She didn't want to take them, but he insisted. She longed to tell him she and Jack were married, but she couldn't. Corinne.
"Thank God for Cousin Tukey," that's all she had to say. When he heard her on the phone crying and carrying on about Steve, about Arthur, about the whole family falling apart, Tukey flew in and took charge, presenting her with a tantalizing idea. Come home to Birmingham. He had his eye on a charming house with a garden just a block from his own. 3 bedrooms, plus a maid's, impeccably furnished, for rent with an option to buy. He'd already put a hold on it. He'd scouted out the best private schools for the girls. There was nothing to be done about Steve at the moment. Be proud of him, going off to serve his country. He's young, he's strong, he's smart. He'll go to college when he's out in a few years. Let Fern go with Arthur for the summer. Send Natalie to the dance camp she's begging to attend. If she loses weight, the camp will be instructed to call immediately. If need be, we'll bring in a doctor to evaluate the situation. When she'd asked, "And then what?" Tukey had taken her hand.
"Then we'll take action. There are rest homes in Birmingham, too, but I'm betting she'll be fine. Give yourself a chance to recuperate, Corinne. When Fern and Natalie get back from summer vacation, everything will be set up. They'll be happy because their mother will be happy."
It was true, she realized. She hadn't been happy in a long time.
"You'll be the belle of the ball, dearest cousin," Tukey promised, "and I will be your dapper escort. Plus, I'm a very good dancer."
And just like that, she stopped crying. Just like that, she was Tukey's little cousin, Corinne. He would take care of her and everything else. The house on Shelley Avenue would stay as it was. Tukey would find someone to live in and watch over it. If she wanted to sell in a year or two, they'd sell. For now, no decision had to be made. No decision. Such a relief. She felt very tired, but the idea of going home to Birmingham filled her with hope. If only she knew for sure what had gone wrong with her marriage. If only she understood how he could leave her for that woman, Miri's mother, no less. It was unthinkable. And when exactly had they fallen so in love they were leaving town together, disrupting so many lives? Was it New Year's Eve, when Rusty twirled in the finished basement with Tukey? If she had never invited her to the party, would it have happened? She could kick herself every time she thought of that night, of Arthur reminding her that Tukey was that way, and she had no business foisting him on Rusty Ammerman. Had it started between them already? No, she didn't think so, because that was the night, after all the guests had gone home, they'd made love to start the new year with a bang, to quote Arthur. And they'd laughed the next morning about their clothes, strewn around the floor of their bedroom. So how had this happened? How could she not have known? Wasn't he just begging her to come to Las Vegas with him? If she'd said, "Yes, of course, darling, whither thou goest," and all that, would they be leaving together to start a new chapter of their lives?
Had she made a terrible mistake? Maybe.
Would Steve be going off to Lehigh with Phil in September if she'd said yes to Las Vegas? Would Natalie get well in the dry desert air? She had to stop asking herself these questions. They only upset her and made everything worse. Seal Rubin gave a luncheon in her honor. Her friends promised to visit her in Birmingham, but she knew they wouldn't. She promised to come back regularly to check on the house, but she knew she wouldn't. 20 years, just like that. 20 years of marriage to Arthur, 3 children, friends, a life. They toasted her to starting over. They didn't need to say what they were thinking. Corinne was the first of their crowd to be divorcing. She wouldn't be the last, though no one would admit to being in an unhappy marriage. "You're lucky, Corinne. You have your own money." Her mother always told her never to turn up her nose at the family money, and she never had. Miri. Newark Airport was still closed and wasn't expected to open anytime soon, so on a warm summer day, Henry drove them to LaGuardia in Ben Sapphire's Packard. Ben had given the car to Henry and Leah as a wedding present, and all 6 of them, plus Fern on Dr. O's lap, squeezed in for the ride. At the departure gate, Miri clung to Henry, not wanting to say goodbye. "I wish you were coming with us."
"Leah and I will come to visit soon, maybe over Christmas."
It would be Henry and Leah from now on. Henry and Leah, who'd been married for a week and were going to Atlantic City tomorrow for their honeymoon. She would never have Henry to herself again. She'd have to share him with Leah, and already Leah was making it clear she didn't want to share Henry with anyone.
"Everything will be different," Miri told him.
"Different can be good."
"I'm going to miss you so much."
"Not as much as I'm going to miss you."
He held her tight until Rusty tapped Miri's shoulder, as if they were at a dance and Rusty was cutting in.
"My turn," Rusty said quietly,
and Miri had to let go of Henry.
"Be happy," Henry told Rusty.
"I'll do my best," Rusty said. "You be happy too."
When it was time to say goodbye to Irene, Henry hugged her tight.
"I love you, Mama."
"Not as much as I love you," Irene told him, touching his face.
By then, all of them were holding back tears.
"Enough with the emotional goodbyes," Ben said. "We're going to Las Vegas, not the moon."
The plane, a silver constellation, looking to Miri like a huge featherless bird with fancy wings, was ready for boarding. Irene carried her white leather train case with her pills, her makeup, and her good jewelry neatly packed inside. She and Miri walked across the tarmac together.
"Aren't you afraid?" Miri asked her.
"What's to be afraid of, darling?"
"You know."
"It's going to be fine, I promise."
Irene gave Miri her most reassuring smile.
"But you've never flown," Miri said. "How can you promise when anything could happen, anything could go wrong?"
"Anything could go wrong any day of the week. What's the point of worrying in advance?"
"How do you stop yourself from worrying?"
"I think of all the good things in my life."
"What about the bad things?"
"There's no room for them inside my head. Not anymore. Now I say live and let live, and I kick those other thoughts away. You can do that, too."
"I'm trying, Nana. I swear, I'm trying."
Irene squeezed her hand.
"That's my girl."
She did not want to flash back to 6 months ago, to that frigid December day when the ball of fire fell from the sky, exploding not once, but twice. She had pains in her stomach now, maybe from not eating anything since yesterday afternoon, when Suzanne had hosted a going-away lunch for her. Tuna salad and deviled eggs, all arranged on a pretty platter, with pale blue ribbons tying up the napkins. The girls were careful not to mention Mason's name,
Robo, who had come from Milburn, brought up the subject once.
Good riddance to him.
Without saying a word, Suzanne and Eleanor let her know she was out of bounds. Miri handed the panda bear from its shelf in her now empty closet to Suzanne, asking her to give it to Betsy in person as soon as Mrs. Foster said it was okay to visit. Suzanne promised she would. They'd chipped in to give Miri a going-away present from Oakley's, a double box of stationery with a Western motif, cowboys, cacti, broncos, decorating the lower right-hand corner of each sheet, plus an Esterbrook pen in pastel green with a bottle of green ink, exactly what she'd been hoping someone would give her for Hanukkah.
Something to remember us by, Suzanne said. As if I could forget any of you.
Miri told them, choking up. She promised to write. They promised they'd write, too. For a while, she thought Mason might come by the house, but he didn't. Once she understood he was avoiding her the way she was avoiding him, she wanted to leave. The sooner, the better. And now she was going. She was going to walk up the steps leading to the silver bird that would gobble her up, holding her in its belly until it reached its faraway destination, where it would spit her out in one piece, she hoped. The stewardess, in her famous uniform with the red cutout TWA logo on her right shoulder, welcomed them onto the plane. Miri was reassured to see that the seating looked so much like a train. She was never afraid on a train. They were seated two by two, Irene with Ben, Rusty with Dr. O, and Miri with Fern. The stewardess handed the two girls silver wings to pin to their jackets. Fern's jacket was turquoise felt with appliqued animals. She asked for a second pin for Roy Rabbit. Miri offered hers, then pinned one to Fern's jacket and the other to Roy Rabbit's well-worn vest.
"Have you been to Las Vegas?" Fern asked her.
"No." Miri resisted a laugh. It made sense to call it Lost, since it was in the middle of nowhere.
"Will you be my sister now?" Fern asked.
"Stepsister."
"Like in Cinderella?"
"No. My mother is very nice, so you don't have to worry about having a wicked stepmother. And my grandmother is the best grandmother ever. Except when she talks about boys, but you don't have to worry about that yet."
"I'm only coming for the summer," Fern said. "Mommy wanted me to go to camp, but I wanted to go with Daddy."
"I'm glad you're coming with us." Miri never thought she'd say that, but there was something comforting about having Fern sitting next to her, her skinny little legs swinging up and down, her cowboy bunny clutched against her chest. She liked having someone to watch over, someone who needed her to be strong.
"Did you know Roy Rogers has a penis, but Roy Rabbit doesn't have one, even though he's a boy bunny?"
"Yes, I know."
"I told you, right? About 100 times.
Fern said,
"I flew one time when I was little, all the way to Birmingham, where my grandma lived. I got to sit on her hospital bed. Then she died. I didn't see her dead, only sleeping."
She was quiet for a minute, then she popped back up.
"Do you know this song?"
She twisted her hands upside down, making goggles for her eyes with her thumb and second finger. She started to sing.
"Into the air, Junior Birdman, into the air, upside down. Into the air, Junior Birdman, keep your noses off the ground."
"Where did you learn that?" Miri asked.
"Natalie learned it at summer camp and taught it to me."
By the time Miri figured out how to make the mask with her hands, the plane was on the move, picking up speed, faster, 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 until they were airborne. "Into the air, Junior Birdman." They were flying. She was flying. She thought it would feel different. More like the ride at the amusement park that pins you against the wall with centrifugal force. That ride was both thrilling and terrifying. But so was this one. Once they'd leveled off, she pretended she was on a train, except when she looked out the window, all she saw was sky with a bank of fluffy clouds under the plane. "Somewhere there's heaven," she sang to herself. Because if there was a heaven, wouldn't this be it? Separated from Earth by white fluffy clouds. She half expected to see angels wearing flowing white gowns playing harps. She half expected to see Penny tapping on the window of the plane to get her attention. If only she believed in heaven.
"What?" Fern asked.
"Nothing. I was just singing to myself."
"What song?"
"Just some song I know."
"Teach it to me."
"Somewhere there's music, how faint the tune. Somewhere there's heaven, how high the moon."
"How high is the moon?"
"Pretty high."
"How do you know you can hear music there?"
"Because you can always hear music."
"That's good. Isn't that good?"
"Yes, it's very good." It was a long trip. First they landed in Chicago, where they changed planes. Between Chicago and Los Angeles, a fancy lunch was served on a tray. Miri couldn't imagine how they managed to cook steak and French fries on a plane. The Parker House roll came with a pat of butter stamped TWA. She had never seen such tiny salt and pepper shakers. She thought about sneaking them into her bag, but didn't want to set a bad example for Fern. For dessert, there was ice cream with a chocolate chip cookie. After lunch, the stewardess handed out decks of cards. Miri and Fern played war until Fern's eyes closed. Miri covered her with a blanket and smoothed her hair away from her face. She was reminded of babysitting Penny and Betsy, but thinking of them made her too sad. She tried to read. Rusty had given her a copy of The Member of the Wedding, about a girl called Frankie who felt she didn't belong anywhere in the world. She wasn't sure if Rusty thought it would appeal to her because they were setting out for the unknown, because Rusty was marrying Dr. O, or just because it was a good book. But she couldn't concentrate. She caught herself drifting off and shook her sleepiness away. She would not allow herself to sleep while she was flying, though when she'd gone to the restroom, she'd passed Rusty and Dr. O, both dozing, and Irene and Ben, both asleep with their mouths partly open. Before they landed in Los Angeles, the stewardess suggested they reset their watches to Pacific time, which was 3 hours earlier than in New Jersey. They changed to a smaller plane for the short flight to Las Vegas. The stewardess handed out copies of the Las Vegas Sun as they boarded. Miri took one, and as soon as she was seated with her seatbelt fastened, she thumbed through it. She stopped when she came to an intriguing headline. Las Vegas Sun. McCarthy loses face in verbal fire. June 30th. What was perhaps the most drama-packed and best-attended political meeting ever held in Nevada broke up in a scene of bedlam last night at War Memorial Hall after the audience had listened to Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, who had purportedly come here to speak on behalf of Senator George W. Malone, now seeking re-election. McCarthy, in his typical wild-swinging fashion, with no regard for facts, but with a hold on his audience that is frightening, called Sun publisher Hank Greenspun an ex-convict and an admitted communist publisher of the Las Vegas Daily Worker. Women shuddered, and strong men controlled their emotions with difficulty as the attacks continued. They had never heard such disgraceful language in Nevada. Cheers rang out when Greenspun responded and challenged the Wisconsin senator to debate these vicious lies. But McCarthy turned and ran like a scared rabbit. Too bad Miri couldn't share that story with Eleanor. They could taunt Donnie Kellen about his hero, McCarthy, except they'd heard Donnie had been shipped off to military school. And who knew the next time she'd see Eleanor? Still, She liked knowing this was the newspaper Dr. O would probably bring home every day. Or maybe it would be delivered to their house. It made life in Las Vegas seem real. They had a newspaper, and the publisher's name was Hank, short for Henry. A good omen. When Fern squealed,
"Here come the bumps! Daddy, it's the bumps!"
Dr. O turned in his seat to look back at Fern, to smile at her, to pat her leg. The smooth air had turned choppy on the final descent into Las Vegas. Miri didn't like it. It wasn't like riding a bucking bronco, not that she'd ever been on a bucking bronco, but she'd seen them in cowboy movies. These bumps were unpredictable. The stewardess told them to keep their seatbelts fastened until they'd landed. Rusty turned to Miri.
"How are you doing, honey?"
"I'm fine." A lie. She was so terrified, she dug her fingernails into the fabric of her seat cushion.
"How about you?"
"Good." But Rusty didn't look good. She was pale, with beads of sweat on her forehead and upper lip. As they came lower and lower in their descent, the scene out the window looked to Miri like a moonscape, or how she imagined a moonscape would look. Sandy and flat, with tall, dark mountains rising out of nowhere. Lower and lower out of the wild blue yonder, lower and lower, until the wheels hit the ground with a thud, and the pilot reversed the engines, making a grinding noise. The captain spoke to them over the loudspeaker.
"Welcome to McCarran Field, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy your stay in Las Vegas. We hope you'll join us again."
She'd survived the trip. Even if she never flew again, which she was sure she wouldn't, at least she'd gone up into the wild blue yonder 3 times. At least she'd done that. The passengers applauded as if they'd been watching a show. They were all yakking, thrilled to have landed at McCarran Field, or maybe thrilled just to have landed. When they were told they were free to unbuckle their seatbelts, Fern jumped into Dr. O's arms. Rusty, still looking unwell, draped an arm over Miri's shoulder.
"We made it."
Yes, they'd made it. But this was just the beginning.
Las Vegas Sun. A-bomb blast thrills. July 5th. Thousands of holiday tourists on the Las Vegas Strip celebrated dawn with the sight of an atomic flash at the Yucca Flat test site 78 miles away. The mushroom cloud was clearly seen, but there was disappointment at the slight shock. 1,000 soldiers, positioned in foxholes only 7,000 yards away from the blast, surged forward minutes after the explosion in a simulated attack to encircle and capture the devastated area. "There were no casualties," the Army announced.
Chapter 35. Miri and Natalie. Natalie came to visit after camp, just before school started.
"Don't get the wrong idea," she said to Miri. "I'm curious, that's all. I still hate them."
"What about me?"
"I don't know about you. Maybe yes, maybe no."
By then they were living in a furnished stucco ranch house east of the city, in a neighborhood of other ranch houses called Rancho Circle. They were all ugly and looked the same. The 3 girls shared a room. Irene and Ben rented an identical house across the street. Their furniture and boxes of stuff were in storage, while Rusty and Dr. O looked for a permanent place. Miri hoped it would be better than this one. Irene kept Natalie busy, kept her away from Rusty, who was pregnant, but not yet showing, and suffering from morning sickness that sometimes lasted all day. It disgusted Natalie to learn Rusty was pregnant.
"So, you're not going to be the only child anymore," she said to Miri.
"So?" Miri was equally shocked to learn Rusty was pregnant, but she wasn't going to admit it to Natalie.
"So, you won't be the center of attention anymore," Natalie told her.
"I've never been the center of attention." But the truth was, it had occurred to Miri that she would have to share Rusty's love once there was a new baby. And maybe Irene's, too.
I hope you like dirty diapers, Natalie said, because they're going to expect you to be the babysitter.
I like babies. She'd never lived with a baby, had never wished for a sibling, like some only children.
I'm just warning you.
Thanks for the warning.
You have to admit it's embarrassing that she's pregnant at 33, and he's 11 years older. I feel sorry for their baby. Think of it. When the baby is our age, your mother will be almost 50, and my father will be 60. They'll be more like grandparents than parents.
But Miri didn't want to think about that. Some mornings, Natalie and Fern rode horses together, and Miri would go along to watch. Dr. O drove them to a ranch 20 miles out of town. Fern named her horse Trigger. No surprise there. Dr. O encouraged Natalie to name a horse, too. Natalie refused, saying he was just trying to buy her love, and her love wasn't for sale. Miri knew from Dr. O that Steve had enlisted in the Army the day after high school graduation. Natalie said it was her father's fault. If her parents had stayed together, Steve would be going off to Lehigh with Phil Stein. Now Steve would probably be sent to co-fucking Rhea. Miri had never heard Natalie use such language. Nobody cared what Natalie did or didn't eat. She developed a taste for the whites of hard-boiled eggs dipped in salt water, like at a seder, and on some days ate that 3 times a day. Dr. O was more concerned about Rusty's constant nausea. The doctor assured them the nausea was a good sign, a sign that it was a strong pregnancy. Eat whatever you can keep down. Rusty told Miri she was hardly sick when she was pregnant with her. Miri said,
"Maybe it's a boy this time."
"Maybe," Rusty said. Irene and Ben took the 3 girls on a day-long trip to Hoover Dam, including a guided tour that Natalie yawned through, though she had to admit the place was impressive, if you happen to like wonders of the world. The tour guide, a friendly Western type, was a different story. Natalie swore he'd made up his mind from the moment he first saw her that she was a stuck-up East Coast bitch. She acted like one, muttering, "Cowboy," loud enough for him to hear. But she didn't mind shopping for Western boots, choosing a 2-color style, the most expensive in the store. Irene didn't bat an eyelash, just told her she hoped they were as comfortable as they were beautiful. In the afternoons, in the scorching summer sun, 100+ degrees, she and Natalie drifted on rafts at the pool at the Flamingo Hotel, working on their tans. The pool at the Flamingo was the only thing Natalie liked about this ugly, bone-dry place. At the Flamingo, there was grass around the pool, the only grass Natalie had seen in Las Vegas. Natalie bet the other kids at the pool were sons and daughters of gangsters. Her mother had told her about the Jewish gangsters who were building this town. She told her about Bugsy Siegel, who'd built the Flamingo, and Longy's Willman, her father's patient, who had lured him here and was a partner in the fanciest new hotel in town, the Sands, due to open in December. These kids would be Miri's classmates at school. If Natalie stayed, they would be her classmates, too. She talked to no one, but Miri did. To a girl whose uncle was involved in the casinos. Janine was her name. She would be a sophomore at the high school, too. Well, la-dee-da, Natalie thought. Miri would have one friend. Not that she cared. Why would she give 2 cents if Miri had a friend or didn't? Natalie and Miri didn't talk about school or anything else. Miri had no idea Corinne told her if she didn't like it in Birmingham, she could go to boarding school in a year, which she was definitely going to do. Nobody knew about that, including her father. One time, Miri tried to draw her into the conversation, introducing her as her stepsister.
"Not so fast, cowgirl. There hasn't been a wedding yet, or am I missing something?"
"When they get married, we'll be stepsisters," Miri said to Natalie.
"Why would I want to be your sister, step or otherwise?
Mary was stung. Not that she'd expected anything different, but still.
All Natalie really wanted was to see the mushroom cloud from an A-bomb detonated every few weeks at Yucca Flats, not that far from town. But her father said absolutely not, which made it easier to hate him. That and the pregnancy. Her father took Natalie to the new office to check her teeth, then took her out to lunch, just the two of them. The whole time they were together, she wanted to cry. She wanted to yell and scream and cry, then have him hold her and say everything was going to be all right. She wanted him to beg her to stay, to live with him. But then she remembered living with him would mean this godforsaken desert in the middle of nowhere. It would mean Rusty and a new baby and Mary. She and Mary would never be best friends again. She saw the writing on the wall. It was over between them. She ordered a Waldorf salad without dressing. On her last night in town, Natalie rolled over in the twin bed next to Mary's, propped herself up on an elbow, and asked, "Is it true about Mason?"
"Is what true?"
"That he had another girlfriend?"
"Who told you that?"
Natalie shrugged.
"You can't trust any of them, not even after 20 years of marriage. Just ask my mother."
Mary lay on her back, trying to dismiss the pain spreading through her body.
"I'm never going to let a boy break my heart," Natalie said. "Not that friends can't break your heart, too. And family. You think you can trust them, then you find out you were wrong. That's all I'm going to say."
She turned away then, leaving Mary awake, tears rolling down her cheeks. Fern didn't want to leave. She wanted to be flower girl at the wedding.
"We're not having that kind of wedding," Rusty told her.
"What kind are you having?"
Fern asked.
"It will be a very quiet wedding in the rabbi's study. You won't be missing anything."
Still, Fern cried.
"I want to be your sister," she told Mary. "I like you better than Natalie."
"Don't tell that to anyone else, okay?" Mary said.
"You mean it's a secret?"
"Not so much a secret as something only the two of us know.
I wish I could stay here and ride Trigger to school. I don't want to go back to Mommy. She's mean. She only cares about good manners."
"Good manners are important.
Natalie doesn't have good manners."
"She used to,
but she doesn't anymore."
"No, she doesn't."
Mary went to the airport with them to say goodbye. Fern wore her appliqué jacket with the silver wings, a second set of wings still pinned to Roy Rabbit's vest. Natalie wore dungarees, her new Western boots, and a fringed jacket she'd seen in a shop window on Fremont Street. All that was missing was a 10-gallon hat.
"Mommy's going to be surprised to see you wearing that," Fern said.
"That's the idea," Natalie told her.
"She's going to be mad."
"That's the idea."
"Are you going to be mean forever?" Fern asked.
"Maybe yes, maybe no,"
Natalie said, laughing. Mary would have hugged her for old time's sake, but Natalie kept her distance, turning once, halfway out the tarmac to the plane, to wave to her.
"So long, cowgirl," she called. "I'll see you in my dreams." "Not if I see you first," Mary called back.
Dr. O was accompanying the girls to Birmingham. They'd have to change planes, and he didn't think they were experienced enough travelers to do it on their own. Natalie disagreed. Rusty was teary-eyed saying goodbye to him.
"I'll be back in 5 days," he promised.
"That's 5 days too many," Rusty said.
When Dr. O kissed Rusty goodbye, Mary looked away. Getting used to her mother in love was going to take time. Getting used to her mother pregnant, that was a whole different story. The plane's engines revved up. It taxied to the runway, then picked up speed until it rose into the air.
"Into the air, Junior Birdman,"
she imagined Fern singing.
her hands making upside-down goggles over her eyes. Miri waved at the plane, even though the passengers couldn't see her. Inside her head,